Government Operations and Elections Committee will come to order. Ooh, we've got several sets of minutes. Representative Hancock, you've been sitting here for a while. Did you get an opportunity to review the three sets of minutes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have for the 14th, 15th, and 16th, and I would move for their approval.
Representative Hancock moves the approval of the minutes for the March 14th, 15th, and 16th. Any changes or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail. First on our agenda is House File 1492. Representative Wardlow, I'll move that House File, Senate File. Senate File 1492 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate File 1492 is an important bill that changes Minnesota's Fallen Firefighters Memorial Day to be the last Sunday in September of each year, which is 1 week preceding the National Firefighters or Fallen Firefighters Memorial Day, which is the first Sunday in October of each year. Now, fully privately funded money raised by firefighters for firefighters memorial is going to be dedicated this coming September 30th, and this will line up the day of the dedication with Fallen Firefighters Memorial Day and give the families of fallen firefighters in Minnesota the opportunity to visit, go to that ceremony, and then also travel out to Washington, D.C. a week later for the National Day. And I have a testifier here who will speak a little bit more about this. Niall Zickmund is the fire chief of Spring Lake Park, Blaine, Moundsview, and also on the board of the Minnesota Fire Service Foundation.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Niall Zickmund, Spring Lake Park, Blaine, Moundsview fire chief, here today representing all of the fire service groups, which in the past 10 months have worked with the 20,340 firefighters in the state of Minnesota to raise the $600,000. We actually exceeded our target, $667,000, raised amongst the firefighters to build and construct the memorial you see in the brochure. The memorial has been designed by the Leo F. Daley. They're somewhat famous for designing the World War II memorial on the nation's Capitol Mall. They've done all their work pro bono, the brochure, all the printing, everything you see has been done pro bono. We're pretty excited about the product. The statue has been at the Minneapolis airport for the past 20 years. It's since been relocated out to a foundry in Delano to get it prepared to move to the new site when it gets constructed, mostly to beef it up. It was never envisioned to be out in a situation where maybe somebody could climb on that ladder, so they're just going to reinforce that. But we'd ask your support to change this date, and so we would have it every last Sunday in the month of September. As we've gone through this project, we went from 194 identified line of duty deaths to 202 identified line of duty deaths. We've never had a official list. We will have that once this is all done. We've been working on validating that list. You see the columns that are supporting the roof of the monolith. You see some shiny spots. Those columns are laid out in a grid by decade and by year. And so the firefighter that lost their lives would be inscribed on that decade and that year. You just see the artist rendition where you could go buff that and do a rubbing. And so that becomes timeless to add more in there. And then again, as we've been on our journey making presentations around the state, we've had another eight folks come forward that just simply weren't identified or weren't properly recognized as a firefighter death at that time. And with that, I guess, Madam Chair, I'd pause and if you have any questions, but appreciate the committee time and
okay,
the opportunity
to present
this.
Members have questions for the testimony. Representative Beard.
Just to share some advice, Mr. Chairman, because I got involved with a group that was going to build a memorial on the Capitol grounds, too, and come to find out there actually is a very detailed process, and it's harder than it looks. I'll just encourage you to be in touch with the Capitol Area Architectural Board and a few other groups. I know the gist of this bill today is only to move the date, and I'll be supportive of that, but I wish you well in your endeavors, and be sure you check in with that Capitol Area Architectural Planning Commission, because they have a lot of say of what happens around here. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, we've been working with the Cap Board since about a year and a half ago. We've got all the permits through them applied. They're actually in the final stages of preparing all the specifications, and it'll be going out for bid. 7 years ago, we tried to do this, and that's where we learned the lesson of needing to work through the CAP board, and so that lesson was well learned. So when we started at this time, we started with them. So this project is going to go. The money is in the bank. The permits are issued, and plans and specifications are ready to be released, and they've been very helpful to work with. Thank you.
Okay, are there any other member questions? Yeah. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so how did you actually decide who would do the memorial? Did you put it out on bids, or were there a lot of others interested in doing this? You said it was pro bono, but just wondered if you had asked others or what you did.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, George Esmondson, the fire chief in Eden Prairie, is the president of the foundation board, and he headed up that effort. When we tried this effort back in 2004-05, Leo Daly was one of, they did do a RFP. Leo Daly was not the prospective bidder at that time. My understanding is George went back to that list and asked folks who would be interested. They were the only ones that came forward and were willing to do it in a pro bono fashion. They certainly had the reputation, and the price was right.
Okay, any additional questions? Anybody in the audience that would like to speak about this bill? Seeing none, did you have any statement to wrap up?
I'll just thank members for the support.
Okay. With that, Representative Pepin renews her motion that Senate File 1492 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Bill is carried.
Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Representative Gottwald? And where are we going to register with this also? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If somebody would be so kind as to move the bill.
Representative Gottwald, I would move Senate File 1135 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. Welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I have a DE1 amendment as well that you should have in your packets that I'd like to have moved as well so that we can have the bill in the proper order for presentation.
All right. any questions on the DE1 amendment? Seeing none, I'll move the DE1 amendment. Okay. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is approved, and the bill is in the order you'd like it. Go ahead. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, this bill establishes, yeah. I should say reestablishes, the Maternal and Child Health Advisory Task Force for the state of Minnesota. That task force expired last June, and a bill to renew it failed on the House floor. We did not end up getting to it at the end of last session. It is an important task force primarily because it does help us in our application for block grant dollars in this area from the federal government. So there is federal funding attached to this task force in terms of its importance for getting that federal funding. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier if I could.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janet Olstead. I'm with the Community and Family Health Division of the Minnesota Department of Health. The MSAGE Task Force has been in existence since 1982. Its primary purpose is to provide guidance and advice on public health issues that impact the maternal and child health populations to the Commissioner of Health. The Advisory Task Force also supports meeting our federal requirements related to public input into the MCH annual application and report and into our five-year needs assessment. Entertain any other questions?
Do any members have questions? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gottwald, is there any cost to this, and if so, how is it paid?
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, I'm not aware there's a fiscal note on this yet. Perhaps the department has some further indication on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the costs associated with the task force really relates to transportation, reimbursement for transportation, and for the meal during the task force day, which occurs four times a year. Those costs are absorbed out of our MCH block grant, federal MCH block grant dollars.
Right.
Any additional questions from the members? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Gottwald, I see you're extending it to 2015. Is that to line up with the Sunset Commission review of this, or is it doesn't this get reviewed by the Sunset Commission? I don't see it in the amendment you have here.
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm not sure. I know we wanted to extend it longer. I mean, obviously, it doesn't make sense to do this year to year because the reason for having the task force is more long-term. I'm not sure why we chose 2015, and again, perhaps the department has some idea of why we put that in there.
Representative Gottwald, maybe we'd have Mr. Shepard shed some light on that for us.
Oh, very good.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, the Department of Human Services and all of the advisory groups associated with it are sunset in the next cycle, which is for 2014, but the way the sunset law works is that if the legislature were not to continue the groups, they are allowed to stay in existence for another year to wind up their business, and so the date on which they would go out of business is June 30th, 2015. So it actually works, I think, with the date in the bill.
Thank you. That answers my question, yeah.
All right. Any additional questions from the members? Were there any additional testifiers for, against, or about this bill? Seeing none, I would renew my motion that Senate File 1135 be recommended to pass as amended and be placed on the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Okay, next we'll take up House File 2334, Representative Lane. I think she's just out in the hall. Welcome, Representative Lane. I will move that House File 2334 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2334 adds the option for local government employees to participate in the state's long-term care insurance program. And originally, my understanding is that the state long-term care program was originally designed for all local government employees too, but currently it's just limited to the state employees, which includes everybody that's eligible for the CGAP program and all three branches of government, MNSCU, quasi-state agencies, as the Minnesota Historical Society. So it's a large group of people who have the option to use this program. And this is voluntary and self-paid by the employer, by the employee. So it's totally up to the individual. In that sense, the overall consideration is that there's not state costs involved. However, there is some concern that there'd be an increase in Perhaps some administration costs. There would be an increase, perhaps in adverse selection, is the view of some people. Some of this is unsure. We don't know if it would or wouldn't until we do it. But we do have to listen to the arguments on both sides of that. Overall, though, my perspective is that it's a good policy choice. We want people to buy into long-term care insurance because down the line it saves the state a lot of money not having to pay Medicaid for nursing home care. So as a good policy choice, that's why I'm supporting it and bringing it to you today. I do have some testifiers that can clarify some of the facts around this.
Welcome to the committee, and if you just want to identify yourself for the tape.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Representative. My name is Jeremy Zajcik, and I'm the Benefits Manager for Hennepin County. I'm here to testify on behalf of Hennepin County and Hennepin County's support of House File Number 2334. Hennepin County does not currently provide our employees access to a group long-term care insurance program. From the year 2002 to 2008, Hennepin County did offer a long-term care insurance program through Aetna Life and achieved a participation rate of around 7%. But in late 2008, the county received notification from the vendor that the contract would not be extended due to the fact that Aetna Life made a business decision to exit the group long-term care market. Aetna allowed employees to convert their coverage into individual policies established through a trust. Aetna did not provide the county with a percentage of employees that opted to convert the policy, but we do know that many policyholders had legitimate concerns about the trust. For the past 3 years, Hennepin County has kept its pulse in the long-term care market with the intent of offering a group long-term care program again in the future. We have weighed the decision carefully as we have observed a lot of change in the long-term care market. Hennepin County has 7,254 benefit-eligible employees who could potentially benefit from access to the Minnesota Employee Group Long-Term Care Insurance Program. Hennepin County believes it is good policy to encourage employees to plan for their own long-term care needs. We support House File 2334, which expands access to long-term care insurance for other public employers in Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives, for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Hennepin County and in support of House File 2334.
Hi. Did you want to say a few words? If you could just identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Melanie Alt. I'm the Director of Human Resources for Anoka County. Anoka County is also supportive of House File 2334. Our goal is to offer a good long-term care insurance program to our employees. We would also like to see this available to local governments throughout the state of Minnesota along the lines of the way this plan was originally designed. We would like to make it easy and convenient for local units of government to offer long-term care insurance, to make it available to its employees, to boost the number of people in Minnesota planning for their financial future. The program is voluntary. It is paid by the employee, and we're supportive of that approach as well. Allowing local government employees to join the MPEL group is an effective way for implementing such a plan. Originally, MPEL included all local units of government, but they were deleted at the last moment. We would like to see that reinstated. The state of Minnesota, with the early on assistance of local governments, did intensively research, evaluate, and select this as its long-term care insurance offering to its employees, and local units of government do not have such resources at their disposal. This program would make it easy and convenient for employees to enroll at their own choosing. Enrollment forms for state employees are available online. There's a tutorial available online. Such types of enrollment options could be expanded and extended to local government employees as well.
Thank you. Any questions at this point? Representative Quam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, there's an existing pool out there. What is the population of that pool in this program, and what is the composition?
Ms. Holt?
Madam Chair, Representative, the MPEL pool, is that what you're questioning?
Madam Chair, yes, that was the only pool I heard mentioned.
Those are made up of state employees, and I do not have those statistics available. I would point out also there are at least two items in your packet. One is a collection of letters of support from MICA, from Redwood County, from Sherburne County, and from the City of Arden Hills. And there's also a fact sheet that looks like this, to which you can refer.
Representative Quam, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, I did, Madam Chair. I have some concerns without knowing the composition and population of the pool, what the possible impacts to that pool by adding these additional participants. And if I knew what was SOP in the organizations that were participating in this, whether it has evolved into a bargained benefit, which is cost shared by the entities. There just is so much open information. I find it difficult to be able to go forward on something like this without additional details.
Ms. Ault?
Madam Chair, Representative, the insurance is made available through a community pool, and the members that are in that pool are state employees, as well as some smaller agency-type employees. There is no evidence of adverse selection by adding in local government employees. There's nothing to show that they're any more of or any less of a risk than the state employee group. They both work in the same industry. There's no evidence also to suggest that only high-risk people would choose the Minnesota plan. Instead, people from all risk levels would likely choose the Minnesota plan. Any risk that would be ensuing would be spread across the entire community of purchasers, regardless of age or health status or their claims history. There's an economy of scale with a community setting.
Representative Quam?
Yes, Madam Chair. Without actually having data, I don't find it capable to calculate out probable risk. So I have some doubts there. The other thing is, again, the demographics of the workforce populations would have a huge impact, and I don't have any, I'm not seeing any data there. I'm not seeing any actuarial, comments and et cetera. So, again, I feel as if we don't have sufficient information to determine the impacts on this, and that, I don't see this as a trivial endeavor, and I'd hate to damage something without having the information to go forward with.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Blaine.
Thank you. There was a study done in 2010, I believe, that analyzed it from levels that perhaps you would be more familiar with than I am. But in that, they considered the possibility of higher risk from having employees in the local governments who would be buying in maybe the ones who are more at risk. I consider that to be possible, but again, it's an unknown factor because you don't know who. We would be encouraging people to get in when they're younger, and it's cheaper. If they can't afford it now in the current pool, I'm not sure that a small savings would allow them to all of a sudden be able to get into it in this pool. So I'm considering that the same amount of additions across the age spectrum, across the risk spectrum, would get into it as is now. They considered that possibility in that study, and they also considered the increased administrative costs from having to put this together. But I believe that that's been discussed in terms of other means of making it more electronic and easier. So the point is that although we do have to consider seriously the very things you're mentioning, the ultimate thing is that you cannot be sure. And either way, so you're taking it into consideration as risk possibility, but you can't say it'll go either way or the other. And that we have to then move above that to a policy decision for the state of Minnesota, which is the best way to get more people into long-term care, which has an enormous effect, millions of dollars in Medicaid later on as we pay for them at a nursing home level. So I'm just wondering if you have more specific questions that perhaps we could answer, Representative Quam.
Representative Quam?
Madam Chair, so you indicate that there is some data out there that would be available. When would it be possible to get that to committee?
Representative Lane?
There was a 2010 study that she has that
one right here.
It's a thick study. We didn't hand this out. It's a thick study. We have the fiscal note includes the information from that. You must have the fiscal note available. That includes the summary from that.
Thank you. Is that good, Representative Quam? I know there's maybe one or two other people that would like to testify. Maybe we can do that at this time and then take more questions. Julie Blyle. Good morning. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. We represent 43,000 excuse me, public employees, state, local units of government, county, and at the University of Minnesota. We are here today, to be very clear, we support extending coverage of long-term care to all public employees, but we do not support the venue of doing it through CGIP. I think Representative Quam raised some of the concerns with not knowing exactly what the impact would be to the CGIP plan, and because of that, that's our concern with this bill. It's been our concern over the past many years when this bill has come before committees. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public that wanted to testify regarding this bill? Good morning.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson from the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I appear in support. I have, I believe, distributed a letter indicating that support, but I would like to address some of the issues that are causing concern for the committee. I think at least some of the members know, there's a lot of volatility in the provision of long-term care insurance with relatively large premium increases occurring out there currently. There have been some indications that the current local government plan that some local government employees offer through the municipal pool may be cut off. Because I assume the same dynamics, and has a consequence rather than increasing participation, you'll see falling participation if, in fact, that does occur. With regards to the issues relating to costs, relating to additional administrative duties that would fall if you would allow local government employee participation through the MPEL plan, frankly, I think that's quite overblown. There are at least two instances that says that exist currently where local government employees participate in a statewide system, the administration of it is all done electronically. First, local government employees can participate in the state's deferred compensation system. All remission of employee contribution relating to that is done electronically through MSRS, and the same currently exists also through the health care savings plan that also local government employees are allowed to participate in. Again, the administration is relatively easy. All remission of contributions through that is done electronically, so this just frankly is not an insurmountable or, in my opinion, a consequential issue. There may be pennies that would be added to the cost relating to the plan, but that may be totally offset by increasing participation. With that, I'll conclude my testimony. Be happy to answer any questions.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, you had indicated, and I just want to get some clarification. You said that access to the muni pool maybe, in your words, were cut off. Can you explain to me what that means?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding because of this volatility that's occurring in, I mean, this is underwritten by the private sector, that there's a possibility that the current carrier may be withdrawing or no longer writing new policies through the municipal plan the coming year. Again, if that's the case, instead of the increasing participation that we want to encourage, frankly, we try to encourage through the state's income tax credit and the favorable provisions of the state's medical assistance, we may see falling participation or a leveling off of participation, since no new entrants would occur through the group side at the local government level. I've just heard rumors to that effect. I think Ms. Alt may have referenced that in their testimony. I apologize. I was not here for that part of the testimony, but my understanding is that that potentially is at risk.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, the things that you cite about the municipal pool and the volatility and the premium issues there, could that not also be an issue that happens with MPEL as well and the insurance there? So we would have not one problem, but two problems on our hands that would affect more covered persons?
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, Representative, yeah, obviously the actuarial issues that are causing underwriters of long-term care throughout the nation to increase their premiums because of concerns of rising costs and the changing demographics and lifetimes of the covered individuals would certainly extend to MPEL. But again, the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, we as a state try and encourage individuals to purchase long-term care insurance, and the lack of access that exists currently through the group insurance products at the local government level, either because they don't participate in the municipal plan or because there's higher costs through the municipal plan, is counter to the state's overall efforts.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson and Representative Lane, I do support the idea of people having and taking care of their needs with long-term care insurance. The thing I'm most concerned about is if we end up with too many people participating there, that we get those actuarial issues askew, and that really takes and compounds the problem that we were trying to solve. And I do like the idea, and I do want to pursue it, but I am somewhat hesitant to move forward at this point supporting it, because I don't know what's going to happen to MPEL and the people who are in there, and then others who may join that pool. I guess I'd like to have a little bit more information on that. I think the idea is good. I like the idea that the state of Minnesota offers a credit to people who participate in these, and we should be encouraging those types of things, but I also want to make sure that we're doing it in a actuarially balanced fashion. So I appreciate you, Representative Lane, bringing the idea forward. I just can't support it today because I have a few unanswered questions of large magnitude, but I think it's something that definitely we should be pursuing or looking at, not only in this context, but more globally in the state of Minnesota, to encourage just this type of coverage.
Representative Lane?
Yes. Because of conversations that I just recently had this morning, in fact, I would like to ask Minnesota Management and Budget Director of Insurance Nathan Morocco to come down and just speak of his concerns about this, which I think indicated we need to know if this is the right way to go, and so I need to bring this part forth too.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Morocco.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division. In that role, I oversee both the state employee group insurance program that you all participate in, as well as the public employee insurance program. I think the issues have been pretty well stated here in terms of really two primary concerns. One would be on the underwriting, the potential that there's going to be some adverse selection into the existing pool. In discussions with the vendor, which is CNA, they have confirmed with us that they have underwriting concerns here. The premise being that the marketplace has largely been saturated in terms of opportunities for folks to enroll in long-term care. So those who have not taken long-term care to this point are likely fall into one of two buckets, one being they don't want it, or they just, you know, they haven't seen the need for it, or two, that what's been underwritten up to this point has been unaffordable. And it's largely that latter piece that the vendor would have concerns with, that there is some underwriting risk here to the pool. And as that translates to the pool itself, just as a reminder, there are no state dollars here. So this is a great policy discussion that we're having in terms of, you know, ultimately where do folks end up on the state dollars? And in fact, we're having conversations with DHS ourselves about how do we create a more sort of viable, you know, long-term care solution for the state, and where does CGIT fall into that? But I'm not sure that this solution necessarily gets at that, particularly when you consider the AFSCME testimony. These are the individuals that are paying the premiums, not the state. So to the extent that costs need to go up, it's going to be borne by the existing pool. The second concern we'd have then would be on the administrative side. Certainly we've heard testimony about the possibilities to simplify the administration. I would agree that all of those are true. It is possible to integrate local units in with our CGIT program, but that does cost money. Just because there is an infrastructure currently with MSRS doesn't have anything to do with our program necessarily. So, yes, there's all kinds of wonderful technology that would bring all of these payroll systems together, allow us to take payroll deductions, or perhaps create some kind of enrollment or billing mechanism where we can enroll and disenroll people, and we could do that all electronically, but it doesn't exist today, and it would need to be created. And to the extent that either the upfront money needs to be made available, or if we don't create something up front that we simply manage on a manual basis, that will add cost to the program on the administrative side. So I would certainly agree that it's possible to simplify the administration, but it doesn't exist today and would cost money. So those two really in combination would be the concerns that we have, and they're also concerns that the vendor has. It's a fully insured product. CNA underwrites all of the risk. The state is not at risk at all for this pool. What they're telling us is that they have concerns on both of those aspects. So with that, I'll answer any questions you may have.
Representative Murray?
Madam Chair, maybe Mr. Morocco could answer this. How many members are currently in the CGIT plan? How many members are projected to possibly come on if this is adopted? And when you talk about adverse underwriting, we're looking at community rating here, so I'm assuming that that's across the state and not maybe just specific to this group.
Ms. Morocco?
Madam Chair, Representative, the current pool is about 20,000 lives. We allow employees, spouses, and parents of the employee to come into the pool, so it's about 20,000. The underwriting issues related to a pool like this are very complicated. It is community rated, but there can be individual premiums within that community, and this is really putting the vendor somewhat in a difficult position. If you saw the Star Tribune article yesterday about long-term care, the last thing that a vendor wants to do is to raise premiums. The idea with long-term care is that you come in with a fixed premium based on your age, and that is supposed to remain in place up until the time that you actually need to make a claim. So the vendor would really have to see who comes into the pool, what the actual increase would be, and then they would need to submit that to Commerce, and they would make the decision about whether they would increase the cost for the entire community or whether they would somehow segregate the CGIT plan and create a unique premium there, or perhaps there's a way to create a unique premium for the locals. But that's putting the vendor in a very difficult position because, again, the premiums are intended to be fixed for life.
Representative Murray?
Madam Chair, I'd be a little bit worried about that going forward, so maybe some things that we have to work through. It seems like a lot of players in this market have exited recently, and some very substantial players have been getting out of this market. I would be a little bit worried. CNA is a big player in the market, and they've been around a long time, but will they be in this market 5 years from now? So those are concerns that I have.
The other part is, are there any safeguards within this group plan that's going to protect the employees? What I worry about with it, and this is in some of the articles that have just been in the papers and across the country, but in the Minneapolis Tribune in the last few days, the idea of people getting increases of 50 to 75% in their premium. And what I don't want to see is these 20,000 employees getting closer to retirement and all of a sudden their premiums are going up 75%. And so are there any safeguards in this program that's going to make sure that doesn't happen?
Mr. Morocco?
Madam Chair and Representative, as I mentioned, this is a fully insured product which is regulated by the Department of Commerce. So CGIP itself would not have any safeguards or would not have any sort of stop loss per se on a program like this. So it's really up to Commerce to determine what the safeguards are and what they should be and whether there should be any kind of reinsurance or some mechanism to prevent that from happening. But obviously there are times when rate increases are proposed by vendors and Commerce allows them, and there are times when they don't. But I think if there is a group that is actually experiencing increased risk, I think Commerce generally then approves it because it's necessary or the pool will actually go under.
Madam Chair.
Representative Murray?
You see where the problem lies, though, that the employees could get left holding the bag on that. I had just one last quick question here. I think CNA is a very strong insurance company, but any insurance company can fail due to adverse selection or bad investments or whatever. Would these policies be covered by the Minnesota Insurance Pool if something happened to CNA?
Mr. Morocco?
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm not sure that I know the answer to that.
Might be something we want to check out.
Check into?
Yeah.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since the testifier brought up Commerce several times, what is the destination of this, of the motion again?
I moved it to the General Register.
Madam Chair, you know, to me, you know, the insurance aspects, and I've been on several, HHS committee hearings in which insurance was involved, and it seemed like it always went to Commerce. Wouldn't it be more appropriate that it would see that committee?
Perhaps. I don't know that that committee's requested it. Do you want to comment on that, Representative Lane?
As I said earlier, that some of the things that have been brought to me just this morning before we started of these concerns, including from Mr. Morocco, I would either like to move it to Commerce for more discussion or to lay it over because of my own personal concerns as we go forth, because I did want to continue with the discussion because this is a huge discussion that the state of Minnesota needs to have about how we address long-term care. The way we're going is just having people spend down to Medicaid is not the solution. So we need to have this discussion, and the question is whether we have this discussion by moving it on to Commerce or we lay it over for this year.
Well, Representative Sanders, you're the Vice Chair of Commerce. I'm not sure what the agenda schedule looks like. I know we're at some deadline points here, so what would be your advice on this?
Well, Madam Chair, I do know that we do have a full agenda in Commerce with a placeholder for a major bill that may end up getting a hearing in our committee. So at this time, I would have to talk with RCA of that committee, but I do know that we do have a very ambitious and full agenda up through this point, through this week for sure.
Well, Representative Lane, I think that my thought here is that it seems like a lot of members have concerns on the bill, and I have some concerns too. I appreciate what you're doing. I think that you know, we really want to encourage people to move into long-term care. This is a problem our society is facing, but it seems like we've got quite a few members that have some concerns, so I guess my thought would be maybe we could lay this over and look at some of the additional unintended consequences. That would be my suggestion, if you would be amenable to that.
Yes, and there are some other things that are at MMB that need to be looked at too, so I would actually appreciate that.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate you bringing it forward and everyone that had an opportunity to testify. Okay, I'll lay House File 2334 over and we'll move on to House File 2863. Thank you, Representative Lane. Morning, Representative Scott. I believe this needs to go to Ways and Means. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, yeah, I would suppose it would go to Ways and Means.
Okay, I will move that House File 2863 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there should be an A1 amendment. Does everybody have that?
Yep. Would you like me to move your amendment?
Please.
I will move the A1 amendment to your amendment.
Thank you. The A1 amendment, members, simply takes out the in two different sections of the bill where there is a 5% allowance for variance in the Met Council's budget, and this just removes that allowance.
Okay. Any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendment is approved to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As most of you know from my previous visit to your committee, we brought back to life the Commission on Metropolitan Governance Oversight over the interim, and I have a series of bills that relate to that, and this is one of them. This would require that the Metropolitan Council's budget be approved by the legislature. Currently, there's no approval process for their budget other than the council themselves, and I believe that there needs to be a little more light shown on their budget, make them a little more accountable and transparent. I know that they do post their budgets online, but I do believe, particularly since there are no elected officials on the council, that there needs to be some additional oversight, and since we are elected officials, that's why I chose the legislature to have that oversight. This would just require that they, beginning in 2013, start submitting a budget to us, both their operating and capital budgets. Really, that's about the extent of the bill. And with that, I guess I would just open it for questions. Oh, I do have Anoka County Commissioner Rhonda Sevaraja here to testify on behalf of the bill.
Morning, Commissioner Sevaraja. Please identify yourself before you begin.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rhonda Sevaraja, and I am an Anoka County Commissioner. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today in support of House File 2863. I believe that this legislation is not only a benefit to the citizens of the entire metropolitan area, but also to the Met Council itself, because it provides greater transparency to the public and more accountability and oversight by the legislature. It also goes a long way in addressing, I think, the complaint that you have probably heard for quite some time about an appointed body making taxing decisions without oversight by elected officials. And this bill actually addresses that very well. It ensures that as policymakers, you are the ones that are actually in the driver's seat when it comes to oversight of the priorities of the Metropolitan Council and the related capital improvements plan, so that it's actually in line with state priorities and not in conflict with state priorities. It also puts into place clearly defined roles and responsibilities for oversight by the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government, with the timelines that are, again, very transparent, and it will ensure that the Commission will take an active role in monitoring, reviewing, and making recommendations to the Metropolitan Council and to the whole legislature. I believe this legislation will go a long way in restoring the trust that has not been there with the Met Council. And I want to thank Representative Scott for bringing this legislation forward and would ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions at this time? All right, we'll bring on Representative Scalzi. Nope.
Should I?
If you have a question, that's fine. Otherwise, I think we have Mr. Shetton in there from the Met Council to testify.
I just had a comment. I would just like to thank Representative Scott for the good work that she's done this year. I've served on the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government for quite a few years, and I don't recall that we've ever really looked as closely as you have this year, so I just want to commend you for your actions in that regard.
Thank you. Okay, we'll have Mr. Shetton come up.
Uh,
Madam Chair, members, my name is Judd Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. I appreciate the opportunity here to speak to House File 2863, and I am going to surprise Representative Beard by actually supporting one section of the bill. And that would be Section 1 that would deal with having the commission meet at least once per year. I think that would solve a lot of the discussion that we are having today. As Representative Scott mentioned a moment ago, she has resurrected that commission, and they hadn't met for 3.5 to 4 years. And I'm going to get to this in a little bit, but you're being handed out a position of the council opposing this bill in its entirety, but also a copy of the roles and responsibilities of the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance or Government. And if that commission were to meet, I think a lot of these regularly, I think a lot of these issues would be solved. But with that, I'd like to begin my testimony. The council believes that the current structure of the council already ensures public accountability and transparency, and adding this additional layer of legislative approval is redundant and unnecessary. The legislature approves all of the state funds, including our constitutionally dedicated funds, through the normal legislative process. This bill would add authority over funds that are not originated at the state level. Now, the state general fund appropriations to the council make up less than 10% of our operating budget. There are other sources of revenue, like user fees for our municipal wastewater charge, our SAC charge for sewer service. We've got dedicated tax revenues like the motor vehicle sales tax, clean water and parks legacy funds. We have federal funds like the our HRA, Housing and Redevelopment Authority funds, that flow through the council, as they do through 10 other metropolitan area political subdivisions. And there are our property tax levy, that those are some of the varied revenue sources that the council deals with. Now, as I mentioned just a moment ago, there are an additional 10 political subdivisions that have housing and redevelopment authorities here in the metropolitan area. Now, we're not asking through this bill to have all of those political subdivisions come and explain how their agencies or cities or counties or townships are using those funds and passing them through. We also have a lot of money that flows through regarding our capital budget, but those funds come from the county's transit improvement boards, regional rail authorities, and they come through our process similarly to the way other political subdivisions work. Now, regarding our property taxes, the legislature currently sets our levy limits. I mean, that is already in place. So that authority is already there, as well as our general fund funds that flow through the state. As Representative Beard well knows, we spend an awful lot of time talking about how the state general fund and the motor vehicle sales tax are dedicated or appropriated to the Metropolitan Council and to Greater Minnesota Transit and all of the other funds. We also spend that time talking about the parks general fund as well. The legislature already has that authority. This is redundant. They have the authority regarding our property taxes. And as I mentioned earlier to Representative Scott, I think that if the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government were to meet, and again, as Representative Scalzi said, they hadn't met for 3.5 years. And if we were to resurrect that committee and have them meet in June, July, August, as we put together our proposed budgets, that would work much better than meeting a couple weeks prior to the council adopting our capital and operating budgets toward the end of the year. And I think that that is up to the commission to do that. The council has no authority to convene the oversight commission, and that is an additional layer of oversight that no other political subdivision in the state has. We have our own Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government. I think that that's really, really important. To speak to the calendar year budget cycle, we maintain a calendar budget year cycle to be consistent with our other political subdivisions in the state. As I said before, 10% of our operating revenue comes from the state's general fund, and to make that movement to the fiscal year based on 10% of our budget seems counterintuitive to us. The last year, and I'm going to speak to Representative Beard for just a second on this, there's been a lot of talk about the about the transit governance, and it only dealt with transit. And I'm not saying that Representative Scott is tying this to the legislative auditor's report, but they did spend some time looking into our budget, and this was definitely not a recommendation that they made. I also know that Representative Beard is planning on having a large-scale conversation about the council and its overall structure, and I think that if we wanted to have a conversation about this, that would be the proper place to do that. We never had a single conversation about this, the impacts of how this would work through the Oversight Commission, and it's no disrespect to Representative Scott, but I think we need to have a much broader conversation about how this works, because I think the legislature needs to know that they currently have a lot of authority over how that works. I appreciate that. So just to end here, we believe that the council provides active and transparent regional governance and believe that the current oversight of the Oversight Commission and the legislative process provides sufficient authority over the state funds and review of the council's budgets and work plans. Now, if you'd like to look briefly at the handout that I gave you that says Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government, I'd like you to flip to page 2. And under Subdivision 8, it reads Powers, Duties, Metropolitan Council Levy, and Budget Oversight. And again, this is where the redundancy occurs. It says the council must monitor, review, and make recommendations to the Metropolitan Council and to the legislature for the following calendar year on the tax rate and dollar amount of the council's property tax levies and proposed increases, any request for an increase in the debt of the council, the overall work and role of the council, the council's proposed operating capital budgets, which is exactly what we're talking about here, and the council's implementation and operating of operating capital budgets, the work program, and our capital improvement program. So, members, I think that this is completely unnecessary. I think if the Oversight Commission wanted to convene and have that work done earlier in the year rather than in October, November, as we have already have our proposed budgets out, we would be able to work with that no problem. So I would urge you to consider to not passing this bill. Otherwise, I think that there is definitely the issue on section 3, lines 2.32 of the bill that deals with allowing the council, or it says the council cannot adopt a final budget until a law authorizing the council's budget is enacted. And in any year which a law is not enacted to authorize the council's budget, the council may continue to operate and implement its previously approved budget, but at no greater level than previously authorized by the legislature. Now, to me, I don't understand how this works with the state general fund. I have a feeling Representative Beard would like to have a conversation about that and how that works with our state's general fund and the transportation bill. I also think it would be important for the Environment Finance Committee to talk about how that would apply to our parks funding. I just think that this bill isn't ready for prime time and that we currently have all of the authorities in place in order to address this. And for the sake of talking about moving from the calendar year to a fiscal year, I know I would ask or urge Representative Beard to consider that as part of his broader discussion about council governance. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Beard?
Madam Chair, thank you. And I was going to make some comments anyhow, but to Mr. Shettenden's comments, to be clear, the bill that I have been working on deals only with transit governance, does not deal with the overarching question of the Metropolitan Council and how it fits in to the metro area and how we relate to that, we being cities and counties relate to that. So to be clear, I'm only dealing with transit in the bill I deal with. Representative Scott's committee has taken on the larger task of metropolitan governance and that whole thing. Now, admittedly, Mr. Shettenden and members, the largest part of the Metropolitan Council's budget is transit. It's nearly $500 million a biennium now. I think 478 we're up to this year. Next year we're projected to blow through that and go to 518 or 520, something like that, which is another discussion for another day. But it is part of the largest portion in transit, and we do deal now with transit operating on calendar year and the legislature dealing with this fiscal year that starts July 1st. We make that work because there's enough money in the carryover accounts just to for the transit operators to work with. Members, I'm not sure that I see a big problem with having the council do the same or even have them adopt a fiscal year. I noticed, and my question was going to be for Representative Scott, you took out some of the most delicious parts of the bill in your delete all amendment, or in your amendment, I see. But as I'm understanding this, you are still keeping intact the kept going to a fiscal year from the calendar year, and I noticed there was a transitional budget to allow for that to happen. That was going to be in there as well, and I'm just glad you're kind of reinvigorating this oversight committee. So I guess more general comments, except I just wanted to be clear to the members that the transitional portion did remain after your amendment, and that the approval of the budgets still remains after your amendments adopted.
Mr. Shannon?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Representative Beard, I guess one of the points that I was making about this bill is that when we do negotiate our transit funds, we do that through a long, intense process that the legislature already engages with. We do that through MMB, through the governor's office, through the House and Senate, and move that forward. And as we move, if this bill were to move forward, we'd have an oversight commission then that would have another adoption of a budget that the legislature already approved, and that seems extremely redundant to me and unnecessary.
Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are several comments here that I'd like to close with, but just to that point specifically, you know, the transportation committee can still be the one approving that portion of the budget. So there are several ways to work this out, and I think it's just got to take willing participants on all sides.
Thank you. Well, I have Mr. Shetland up here, so I do have some, I guess I have a question for you that kind of relates to governance of the Met Council. Perhaps you can help me understand. You know, I took the bus in Maple Grove for several years, probably 7 years, and it's a fantastic opt-out system. Won awards, things like that, as you know. And it came to my attention recently that the Met Council, my understanding is, did not provide some MVES funds to Maple Grove in the opt-out, several million, maybe 4 million. I don't have my file with me, 4.2 million. So the vast majority came from Maple Grove, and it came out of their budget that was going to be used to help build the second phase of their shelter. And if you could just run me through what it is that gave the Met Council the authority to do that, why that happened, and why, in my view, Maple Grove was punished for being efficient and disproportionately so. I'd just like to understand how that happened and why that happened and what it was that allowed the Met Council to withhold those MVES funds from the Maple Grove opt-out.
Madam Chair and members, you're talking about the budget agreement that we came to agreement late last summer. And how that occurred was there was a $50, $51, $52 million budget target that was provided to Representative Beard, Senator Gimsey, and the council, and we had to find a way to address that. There were participants, a number of participants in that. We had Greater Minnesota Transit. We had a $15 million contribution from the County Transit Improvement Board. We had a contribution from the opt-out providers, which four of the six opt-out providers participated, including Maple Grove. The Metropolitan Council participated through the use of our Ralph levy, through the conversion of capital, federal capital funds that we converted to operating funds. We did some service reductions and administrative reductions. But the piece that you're talking about deals with the use of budget reserves from four of the six opt-out providers. And at that time, four of the six opt-out providers had annual operating reserves of between 100% and 200%. And Maple Grove, I believe, was over 200% of their annual operating reserve at that point. And what the budget agreement dealt with was taking, making sure that it didn't affect the current operations of a transit system where it would, say, not allow a current system to have a cut that would go into their operating costs, so they would have to cut service and cut staff. So what happened is that we took four of those four of the six and reduced them down to a level of somewhere between 50% and 100%. I believe that the Maple Grove annual operating reserve is somewhere between 75% and 100% right now. I think it needs to be clear that the council's operating reserve is 8.3%. It's at the minimum recommended amount that the legislative auditor recommends. For the opt-out providers, the auditor recommends they maintain an operating reserve somewhere between 25 and 35%. As I mentioned, those four still maintain operating reserves somewhere between 50 and 100%, and the council's hasn't changed. I should also note that the council provides roughly 91%, 92% to 94% of all the rides in the region. And Representative Pepin, I cannot agree with you more. I think that the Maple Grove folks provide a fantastic service. They are our partners, and we completely agree with you, as are all the other opt-out providers out there, including MBTA and Southwest Transit. Those two did not participate in the budget reduction scenario because they are at an operating reserve right around the 25%, which is at the lowest part of the auditor's recommendation, just like ours is. And so there's another set of funds called the Regional Allocation Funds, which is the MVEST between 21.5% and 36% of the motor vehicle sales tax that was constitutionally dedicated. Those funds go into this regional allocation model. And when providers, meaning Metro Mobility, the Dial-A-Ride system, Metro Transit, North Star, the light rail line, Hiawatha line, or our regular route or our express route service, along with all the opt-out providers, if at any point they get below their minimum reserve, we can go to that regional allocation model and make sure that they're able to maintain the current service. And that was part of the agreement that we had moving forward last year in the budget bill. Now, that bill, you remember, it had a very massive cut originally to the transit system of about $109 million. We were able to work this out through a negotiated budget agreement last session that allowed us to able to provide service and staff for those providers, including the opt-out providers. And again, these were reserve dollars. And Representative Pepin, I agree, Maple Grove Transit provides a fantastic service, and they are our partners in this. And it was a tough budget.
Thank you, Mr. Shetton, for that explanation. And being a Maple Grove representative, that was a very hard cut to take because it punishes the people that take that system and put the plans on hold for the next phase. And as you know, the ridership in that area is unbelievable. Right. And the growth is of, and the need for the service is expanded greatly, and it kind of seems like Maple Grove is being punished for being successful. That's what it kind of feels like. I wanted to hear from you exactly how that happened and let you know that was pretty frustrating. But I'll move on. I see someone else that wants to testify, and then we can take some other additional questions.
Madam Chair and members, good morning. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, and we do represent cities across the seven-county region at both the Legislature and Metropolitan Council. And I know I've said in here before that we do serve as essentially the city watchdog and liaison at the Met Council. We do appreciate Representative Scott's bringing forth discussions about the Met Council. We think that's timely and important. That said, we do have some specific concerns about this bill in particular, and it's taking of legislative review of the Met Council's budget to a new level. Our legislative policies generally support greater connections between local officials and Metropolitan Council officials, and we do have specific policies that recommend strengthening those relationships through changes made to the nominating process for the selection of Metropolitan Council members. We don't believe that more direct legislative control over the Metropolitan Council's budget, which, as Mr. Shetland indicated, is made up with a lot of user fees and locally generated property tax dollars. We don't believe that this would serve to enhance the relationships between local officials and Met Council members, and that's really our key goal in terms of strengthening the collaborative nature of the role of regional governance and government with the role of local officials. So I just wanted to express the concern. We do certainly support a broad look at the Metropolitan Council's role and functions, and we think that that would be more appropriate before a change like this or any other significant changes to the council are made. Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions for Representative Scalzi?
I have a question for Mr. Shetland, if he could come back down.
I'm sure he'd be happy to.
Mr. Shetland, I understand that the Met Council currently has condemnation authority, and I'm wondering how often this has been used, say, in the past 10 years. Do you have any off the top of your head?
Mr. Shetland?
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, I don't know. I will have to talk to our folks. I was ready to speak to the bill, and I would be happy to follow up with you in the committee if you would like. I can find that out very quickly. I don't know that. It would take a hour for me to find out. That's okay.
And I appreciate that.
Representative Scalzi.
And if you can get that to us, that would be helpful.
Yep.
And I just want to, you know, there's lots of things we could say, and this bill, I think, is a good step. But when we talk about enhancing the collaboration with local elected officials, we have to always be aware that the Met Council did sue the city of Lake Elmo because they didn't want to develop. So, I mean, there's many different ways to look at collaboration, and Lake Elmo was forced to develop and run sewer lines, and they're going to do that. But when this is a first step in my mind, because we have here a non-elected body that can raise your taxes, can condemn property, and can sue a local government. We need some more controls of the situation because it's not a good situation. And that's my comment.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, again, the bill that we're talking about today deals with our budget. What you're talking about was the Land Planning Act, and again, that went through all the way through the court system. And again, we were able to finally reach a settlement with the city of Lake Elmo that was, I think, better than what the courts said that we had to do through the Land Planning Act. So we are trying to work very cooperatively with that. I think Patty Nauman from Metro Cities would be able to speak to that. We process, you know, thousands of comprehensive plans and comprehensive plan amendments. I would say 99% of them are. We work very closely and cooperatively with those cities. But again, that sec, what you're talking about deals with the council's Land Planning Act and the Metropolitan Development Guide. And you know, I think that it is important for the council to be accountable. But when the council is appointed by the governor, they serve at the pleasure of the governor, and they serve coterminous with the governor, and they are confirmed by the Senate. And there is this statutory commission called the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government that provides all of those oversight duties. And I think that everything that is trying to be accomplished through this bill can be done through the Oversight Commission. I believe that.
Representative Scalzi.
And I would just, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would just like to add that the budget is related to all of these other issues. It's related to all of them. You can't just say the Land Planning Act is set over here and the budget is over here, because they're interrelated. So I guess that's the reason for my comments.
Thank you, Representative Scalzi. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Building on Representative Scalzi's comments and the comments of the testifier in the handout to the committee, you know, the testifier stated, you know, you don't have this on, you know, other governmental entities. The last bullet on the left-hand side, no similar requirement is being considered for counties and cities. You know, their political subdivisions of state. Well, last time I checked, counties and divisions of state. Well, last time I checked, counties and cities are elected by the people that live there. And I see that as being the distinct difference as to why the legislature would extend additional oversight out of an entity that gains its power from legislative authority, because cities and counties gain their power from the people and residents and the voters of those entities, and those citizens exert that oversight when they vote for the members. The legislature is appropriately looking at exerting this oversight statutorily, and so I support this bill.
Mr. Shetland?
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I appreciate your comments. I'm speaking to the fact that the council is designated as a political subdivision of the state, similar to cities and counties, and that we have to follow those same processes that cities and counties have to do. I think, again, speaking to the council and their appointees, we are 100% accountable to the governor, who is an elected official in the state, and we also go through the budget cycle with the legislature when we talk about the funds that originate through the state. We also have a unique piece of statutory authority that we deal with called the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government, which, unlike other political subdivisions, they don't have that. And so we do have that. So in order to provide that additional oversight, we believe that that could be handled that way. And again, commission's duties state that they are to review, make recommendations, and I think that if the commission were to meet earlier in the year when we are developing the budgets, that all of that could be addressed at that point, because we believe that for the funds that are originated at the state, that there is the process that we go through in order to make sure that the state appropriately reviews those, including our property tax levies. As I mentioned earlier, the legislature sets our levies. If the council would like to come back to raise those levy limits, we would need the approval of the legislature, and I'm sure that the Oversight Commission would have those discussions there as well. So when I was talking about the no similar requirement is being considered for cities and counties, it's because of our status as a political subdivision, and I'm sure that Ms. Dyson could explain that if you're interested.
Representative Quam?
No, I think I understand the situation well enough.
Mr. Shutton, I think generally, I think most of the legislators have had a chance to look at the OLA report, and some of the recommendations I don't have in front of me were that there should be some elected folks that sit on the Met Council, and I think you can see kind of a bipartisan frustration with the lack of elected officials, and we're not solving that with this problem, but I think the several of my cities where I've had town hall meetings have told me their frustrations with the Met Council and not feeling like they were being heard and that they had any control to do anything about things that the Met Council was doing that they didn't like. And so I think just overall there has to be some changes at the Met Council, and this bill doesn't take on everything, but I think generally that we do need to look at, as a legislature, a way to make sure that their elected officials in some capacity, whether directly elected or whether including members that have been elected in their communities through the council or as a mayor on the council. So that's just my feedback. I'm hearing that from my communities. I'm hearing that from colleagues. And I wouldn't be surprised if there was such legislation in the future.
Representative, or Mr. Madam Shetton. Chair, members, the council has stated, going back to our comments to the legislative auditor on that report, that we would welcome a comprehensive discussion about council governance that includes all of our areas, not just transit, but wastewater, our land planning, our livable communities funds, our entire system. We would welcome to have that conversation and talk about governance. So you have a willing participant. If somebody would like to convene, if the legislature would like to convene that, I know Representative Hornstein has a bill to do that. We are happy to participate in that and have said that since the legislative auditor's report came out last January 2011.
Thank you. Well, we'll look into that. Any other questions for Representative Scott on her bill? Or anyone else that needs to testify? Okay, seeing none, Representative Scott, I'll renew my motion that House File 2863 be recommended to pass as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Do you want to have closing comments?
Yeah, just a few if I might, Madam Chair. Well, we heard from Anoka County Commissioner that this oversight would help enhance the relationship with the Met Council. One of the things that the OLA did find was, and this was just in transit issues because that's the purview of that study, but one of the things that they found was that there was just a lack of trust. And so I think this would go a long way towards helping to mend that situation. The thing about the commission is it is a commission. It's not a full committee. And if you look under Subdivision 8 that Mr. Shetland passed out, On that second page, the commission must monitor, review, and make recommendations. It's only recommendations, folks. There's no teeth to that. And we can make recommendations all day. Doesn't mean that anyone has to abide by the recommendations. This bill gives teeth to the commission and the oversight. And I think it's really important to remember how big the budget of the Metropolitan Council is. Hundreds of millions of dollars every biennium with a lack of oversight. And I don't think that's a healthy situation. So I would just ask that the members would support this bill. Appreciate your time.
Okay, again, I'll renew my motion that House File 2863 be recommended, pass as amended, and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, nay?
No.
Motion does prevail. And meeting is adjourned. See you tomorrow.